So there is a question you never really want to hear. Picture the scene. You've been pulled off to the side of the road. The police officer stops behind you, approaches the door, asks you to roll down the window, and then says, "Do you know why I pulled you over?" Not that I've ever been there, of course. I've seen it in movies and whatnot. "Do you know why I pulled you over? You've already done the deed. The judgment is coming. The ticket as well. Do you know why I pulled you over?" It was impressed upon me in seminary that that is pretty much the message of the biblical prophets. By the time the prophet arrives on the scene, it's pretty much too late. The prophet's message is to tell the people why the judgment is coming, because it is coming. Do you know why this thing is happening? Do you know why it is that the armies of opposing empires are coming to your doorstep? It is because of this. And then the prophet, often at great lengths, tells the people of God why it is that the judgment has come. We do enter into the section of the Bible that they call the minor prophets, or in German, the small prophets, right? The kleine Propheten, the little prophets. I always love that image. The first one is Hosea. A very interesting story. Sometime take a journey through the book of Isaiah, but suffice it to say that Hosea enters into a relationship where the woman whom he marries is unfaithful to him. Yet, despite her unfaithfulness, God moves Hosea to find her, to care for her, to welcome her back despite her wayward ways. In this way, the prophet not only speaks metaphors of God's people leaving God in unfaithfulness, but actually embodies it through his life and through his human, very all too real relationships. But Hosea has a message to God's people. Let us remember the scene. People have been freed from Egypt. They have made it to the promised land. After a period of the judges, they settle down into a kingdom. Much to God's chagrin, they ask for a human king. God says this is not going to go well, but gives in, and lo and behold, the people find it does not go well. Only after a couple of generations, this unified kingdom of Israel is split into two, rendered asunder, much as God's heart is. To the north is Israel, to the south is Judah. We know from our history books, the outside the Bible sources, that there were two great empires that marched in succession, and God's people fell to them, each one in turn. Israel to the north fell to Assyria in 722-ish BC, and just over 150 years later, 586-ish BC, the southern kingdom of Judah falls to Babylon. Now, I know not everyone is a history buff or even interested in historical dates and names, but it does help us out if we remember some very basics. So I have to say, if there's two dates you want to try and remember, just think 700-ish BC and 600-ish BC when the kingdoms fell. And I have a mnemonic that helps me remember. If you go north to south, it's alphabetical. Israel, Judah, Assyria, Babylon. How convenient. It is the first scene that we have. People think that this was written about 10 years before the fall of the northern kingdom, so 730-ish BC. That's the scene in which Hosea delivers his prophecy, the judgmental words of God that God's people have failed because they have sought to play the games of the world's religions and the world's politics, not God's ways of both religion and politics. They tried to be a player on the world stage, and they have failed miserably, seeking after other gods and other kings. But on the bigger scene, some would say the biggest scene possible, is that God's heart is broken. God's heart yearns for God's people that they might return to Him, that they might give up their wandering ways. Like Hosea's wife, Gomer, they might behave, might come to their senses and understand where life is truly found. The chapter we have from Hosea today is this beautiful, poetic utterance from God, God's self. Oh, how I love my people. How I love these children. How I love this nation that I birthed through the Exodus out of Egypt. Oh, my hopes and my dreams for them, that they might learn to live with one another and with me, their God, and that they might teach the nations of the world these most important things of human existence. God's heart has broken. Years ago on internship, Monica and I were privileged to go to a talk at Penn State University where we were for the year for internship. The great Elie Wiesel, a Holocaust survivor, one of the very first in the 1950s to write about his family's experience in the Holocaust. There's a lot that surrounds the scene. I can fill you in sometime. It was quite an experience. But one thing I never forget was his rhetorical question as he's going along in his presentation. He asks, "Who is the Bible's most tragic figure?" When you think of tragedy, when you think of just despair, of being heart-wrenched, who comes to mind? He said Job, definitely.
Zedekiah. The last king whose children were killed before his eyes.
All right, yeah.
And then his own eyes taken.
All right. I thought this was rhetorical. This is great. Any others? Any others? Elie Wiesel offered perhaps Moses. Moses is always between a rock and a hard place, between God's will and the people's will. Never seeming to please either. Elie Wiesel proffered perhaps Abraham. Abraham was called to go and sacrifice his son. And then he said, maybe it's Isaac, the son, who looked up to see his father with knife over his heart, ready to sacrifice. Who is the most tragic figure of the Bible? Elie Wiesel said, no, it's God. Over and over and over again, the scripture tells us the story of a heartbroken God. A God, however, never tires of seeking after God's own to bring them back into the fold, to care for them as only God knows how to care with unconditional, infinite love. Again, the poetry we have in today's text likens God to a mother bending over the crib, scooping up a newborn in her arms and holding that newborn close to her cheek. A wonderful scene of intimacy and love. God scooping down, or bending down, and scooping up. One thing this text, I think, does for us is dispel the notion, or help to dispel the notion, that there is an Old Testament God of wrath and anger and vengeance, and a New Testament God who is loving and kind and graceful and gallivants around in sandals and robes, right? Here we have a picture of the Old Testament God intimately loving. Again, as a mother cares for her infant, of a husband caring for his wife, of one who longs and yearns to be in healthy, committed relationship. Some have said this section from Hosea reminds us of the incarnation of Jesus. The incarnation that God would come down to earth and care for the world by being lifted up on the cross. That very, perhaps on a cosmic theological sense, the same as bending over a crib and scooping up an infant, so God comes to the earth and gathers us all in God's arms. A powerful image. Perhaps, too, we might be reminded of the story of the prodigal son, of that fatherly figure who waits for the prodigal son to return, who every day looks to the road to hope that the son might return to him. But the story, or the picture we have in Hosea, is not of a parent that waits for the child to return, but seeks after the child. It's as though the father and the prodigal son puts on the knapsack and the walking sticks to go look for his son. Not content to wait to see what would happen, but active in the pursuit of this loving relationship. Now, despite Hosea's words, it's too late. The people of God need to know why Assyria is coming. It's because they've gone from the ways of God. But God does not give up. God's love is more powerful than Israel's sin. And it will be a long road to hoe, but eventually God will act and send a king who is at the same time human but also divine. God does not give up on God's people, but provides for them an intimate love. Ultimately, we proclaim in the person of Jesus Christ. May we hear Hosea's proclamation of a loving God who brings us in God's arms to God's very cheek.